Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the new book, A Higher Form of Killing, 6 Weeks in World War I That Forever Changed the Nature of Warfare, historian Diana Preston chronicles the birth of weapons of mass destruction, specifically poison gas, the torpedo, and the Zeppelin, and the dramatic events surrounding their use. In the process, the book sheds new light on World War I as well. Again, the title of the book is A Higher Form of Killing, 6 Weeks in World War I That Forever Changed the Nature of Warfare. Diana Preston joins us this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
What brought you to these 6 weeks and looking at them in such detail?
Well, it began a few years ago when I wrote a book about the sinking of the Cunard liner Lusitania in the first year of the First World War, the event that ultimately helped precipitate the entry of the United States into the First World War. Very dramatic maritime disaster, a pivotal moment in the First World War. But what particularly struck me at the time was the context within which the sinking happened, that just about 2.5 weeks before the Lusitania was attacked, on the 22nd of April, we see the world's first poison gas attack when German troops unleashed chlorine gas over French and Canadian soldiers at Ypres in Belgium. And then about 3 weeks after the sinking of the Lusitania, we have the first bombing of London, the first blitz, if you like, with a Zeppelin drifting over residential areas of London, indiscriminately lobbing bombs on the citizens below. And it seemed to me that those 6 weeks in spring 1915 were a watershed after which, you know, warfare would change, after which no technology would be considered too indiscriminate to employ in warfare. And I think we see the beginnings of something that we still feel the effects of today, the beginnings of psychological warfare, of people, whether civilians or military people, not being able to feel safe at any time, anywhere. We live with the consequences, I think, of what happened a century ago.
And as you point out in the book, with this first use of poison gas by the Germans, the world condemns this, of course, immediately, but then suddenly understands its importance, and with that, there is some justification that they would have to use it as well.
Exactly. That's what I found one of the most telling things, because, you know, the poignant part of the story is that in the years leading up to the First World War, there had been a series of intergovernmental international conferences held, you know, to consider how to stop war breaking out, and if it did break out, how to conduct it in a civilized way. And poison gas was one of the weapons which had been specifically outlawed, specifically banned. But what you, as you say, what you have happening is that as soon as Germany deployed poison gas in April 1915, you have Britain immediately considering poison gas as a response, using it herself just 4 months later. And then after the entry of the United States into the war in 1917, you have the United States also starting to use poison gas. And, you know, it struck me as quite significant that by the time you reach the end of the war, 1918, America had a facility for making gas-filled shells at Fort Edgeworth Arsenal in Maryland that would be the biggest military technical project until the Manhattan Project.
And
you have, you know, both sides, Germany and the Allies, using poison gas. And by the end of the war, you have 63 different types of gas having been trialed by both sides, which I found quite frightening.
And what you see in reading the book and over this time is that how all of these methods would be enlisted to help Germany embark on this thrust, really a lethal thrust, in the spring of 1915.
Exactly. I mean, what you see happening in spring 1915 is all the technology, everything that was now at the disposal of scientists and technologists and engineers in a highly technological age, under the impetus of war, being directed towards creating weapons of mass destruction, we could call them, exactly the kind of thing happening once war began, that those conferences we were talking about before, realizing that this was now an industrial age, had tried to prevent. And as soon as you have that series of events unfolding in spring 1915, it's like the opening up of, you know, the lid of a Pandora's box. You can't reverse what's happened. You can't go back to the situation as it was before. And so, you know, during the First World War, you see poison gas being used by both sides. In the years after the First World War, you see indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations being used on all sides. You see the torpedoing of merchant shipping without warning, like the Lusitania. Because all the acts we were talking about, you know, those critical 6 weeks of 1915, were all illegal at the time. But during the First World War and subsequently, all the question of international frameworks of law governing warfare all got pushed aside by all parties. You know, the justification being that, you know, the end justifies the means.
And on that point of the end justifying the means, you do look at the psychological aspect of this, of what it takes for us as humans to have an imagination available to come up with these weapons that would kill mass numbers of people.
Exactly. I mean, I think for as long as human beings have been on the earth, we've looked for ways to kill each other and frighten each other. But of course, what happened by the time you reached the end of the 19th, early 20th century was that we had enormous technological power to devote to that. And so what you see happening in the spring of 1915 is a very determined attempt to spread a war of terror, psychological warfare, we call it today, and the means to do that. You know, it's quite interesting if you look at some of the justifications which were made at the time for the use of those new weapons, say poison gas. The scientists who created it, particularly the German chemist Fritz Haber, he said, you know, of course this will kill people on the battlefield, but more important than that are the what he called the psychological imponderables it will create in people's minds. The idea was to so terrorize, demoralize soldiers on the battlefield that they wouldn't be able to fight on. And the same thing with the blitzing of London, you know, that indiscriminate bombing of civilians by Zeppelins. The idea was to raise such tremendous firestorms in London, you know, the Germans called it their Feuer plan, the fire plan, to create these terrific firestorms that would just cause the civilian population of London to say to their government, you know, we must make peace immediately, we can't fight on. So some of the justification for the terror that we've been talking about was that it would actually bring the war to an end earlier and in a certain sense help save lives, the justification which of course has been used many times since the First World War.
Talk a little bit about, and we touched on this, but talk a little bit about these three means of mass killing. And were they always designed or thought to be used in concert with one another or very separate projects?
I think they evolved separately, these three different... They evolved separately in terms of their technological scientific development, but they had one root cause, if you like, because we have to consider what the military position was like at the start of the First World War. By the end of 1914, you know, the war in Europe had begun the previous August, but by the end of that year, a stalemate had been reached. You had Germany facing Britain and Britain's allies along a line of trenches, you know, stretching some 450 miles from Switzerland to the North Sea, a war of attrition, you know, not really going anywhere. So Germany at that time, looking for, if you like, a quick fix, a way to unblock that stalemate, and looking to three different strategies, three different weapons to help achieve that. Poison gas was one. It had been decided as early as about September 1914 to seek ways of developing a poison gas. The initial idea was that it would be a gas that would put troops temporarily out of action, perhaps like tear gas, something like that. But as it became clear that the war was stalemated, views in Germany hardened, and the instruction then became to develop gases that would put people permanently out of action, i.e. kill them. So that was sort of the development of one type of weapon. At the same time, with Zeppelins, aerial bombing, the potential for that, again, depended on the speed with which Zeppelins were being developed and the capabilities that their developers thought that they would have. That came sort of together in the spring, early summer of 1915. Plus, of course, the Kaiser, supreme warlord at the time, had to give his permission for the bombing of London. He was a little bit squeamish about dropping bombs on his royal relations in Buckingham Palace. So that had to be got out of the way. And as far as, you know, the question of torpedoing merchant shipping like the Lusitania without warning was concerned, that was an idea which came from within the German Admiralty, who saw the destruction of Britain's merchant shipping as a way of cutting off Britain's supplies, bringing Britain to her knees, and also as a form of revenge for the long-distance blockade of German ports that Britain had at that stage introduced with somewhat dubious illegality. So the three different weapons, the three strategies, having slightly different technological roots, were all coming together almost by serendipity in that spring, early summer of 1915. All were ready to be deployed, but it hadn't been originally conceived as having been a sort of three-pronged concerted action.
1915, 100 years ago, and it's very hard, Diana, to read this book, especially when you are writing in such detail about Zeppelins, and not just suddenly go to the front pages of every newspaper in the country and in the world, perhaps, about drones.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, that's one of the lessons that I take from this, and one of the things I discuss in the book is the need for us to question our moral conscience, if you like, to consider how we use the technology that we today have at our disposal. I mean, we ourselves, as ordinary people, we suffer in the same way that people in 1915 suffered. We have threats that might have seemed inconceivable. I mean, just recently, we've had terrorist threats made in the UK, the US, elsewhere, about shopping centres. You know, we ordinary civilians don't feel safe going about their ordinary lives, as people ceased to feel safe in 1915. And at the same time, we ourselves, as those in positions of authority in 1915 had, we have weapons of massive destructive power, great technological sophistication. The onus on us, I think, all the time is to consider this question which bedevils everything of, you know, ends justifying the means, and to keep questioning and keep being sure that we are making the right moral judgments. Very difficult to do, I know. Lots of arguments around that, but I think to retain our humanity, we need to keep asking ourselves the questions that in 1915 many people failed to ask themselves and too readily abandoned their moral scruples.
And it seems that while on one hand we will condemn someone for having nuclear weapons, or we will condemn someone for having the ingredients to produce such weapons, we still will go through a plan that has the capability of killing mass numbers of people. And it's the overall ethical question seems to have conditions.
I think so. I think that's absolutely right. And I think we must never lose sight of the question of the moral high ground. I mean, it was very striking in 1915 how readily Germany gave that moral high ground away and what damage it did to her cause. Even if you go back before, you know, the weapons we've been talking about, the initial dash through Belgium to get to France, violating Belgian neutrality, completely illegal. As the German Chancellor admitted in an addressing the Reichstag right at the start of the war, he said, you know, we've committed an illegal act, but of course it will all be justified because we will bring the war to an end very quickly and we will achieve our objectives. And what seems illegal and morally reprehensible now, in just a couple of weeks' time, will be considered the laudable, the sensible path to have taken. And I think we have to, perhaps in some of the judgments that we make and the very difficult issues which face us today, have to remember how easy it is to get seduced down that path, to consider the importance of maintaining the moral high ground and not to allow ourselves to start making hypocritical judgments or statements.
Well, the book is very powerful and very important. It is A Higher Form of Killing, 6 Weeks in World War I, the Forever Change, the Nature of Warfare. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. Diana Preston, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning and sharing your expertise. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure indeed. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, A Higher Form of Killing, by Diana Preston, published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.